Let's turn, please, to Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21. Actually, tonight, we're going to be looking at the plot to kill Paul, which is in chapter 23. However, I'd like to go back and hit some of the highlights that have brought us up to chapter 23. And we go back to chapter 21 and verse 17. When we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And now the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Now, from this point on, everything that happens to Paul is bad. The trip in Jerusalem almost gets him killed on several occasions. But as he arrives at Jerusalem, nothing really goes well at all. And we'll want to note that in this chapter 21, though we've studied it before, the impact of what the elders suggested goes throughout the rest of this chapter, all of chapter 22, all of 23, all of 24. And it's literally one event after another that came off of one single thing that the elders suggested and Paul did. And that is down at chapter 21, verses 23 through 26. This is pivotal. The impact of it is enormous. If you took the event in these verses out of the picture, you would be wiping out the next chapters in the book of Acts, which is event after event, ending up with him before Felix, who is a Roman governor, and he would have never been before Felix. He would have never had a riot in the temple. None of the things that followed would have ever happened if these verses were not present. But as he reports the results he's been having to the Jerusalem elders, they say following in verse 23, "Therefore, do this that we tell you." And what they tell him to do will impact everything else. And one will sweep through rapidly and to see those as we come down to chapter 23, verse 12, the focus of our study tonight, the plot to kill Paul. So verse 23, "Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them, purify yourself along with them, pay their expenses in order that they may shave their heads." This, of course, is all Jewish custom. "And all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed," and again they say there's an exception with them, and notice Paul acquiesces. The whole point is, let's appease the Jews by what you're doing, Paul. So, verse 26, "Paul took the men the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the purification, days of the purification, until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them." So, let's go back to then what we can call a pivotal event, and notice everything that flows from it. The pivotal event is the agreement of Paul to go into the temple and engage in a Jewish act. And so let's put beside it, it was a Jewish act intended to appease. A Jewish act intended to appease. And that act will literally impact everything that comes out from it. So that out of that pivotal event, and we'll make this sort of a, like a flowchart, out of the pivotal event, a rumor starts. And the rumor that starts is Paul took a Gentile into the temple. Where only the Jewish males could go. That was a rumor, but it was one that was believed, and it's one that had enormous impact. Verse 29, as he goes into the temple, it says, "They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian," of course he would be non-Jew, he's Greek, "in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." And with that rumor, all the city was roused, and everything stays in riot state through the rest of 21, all of 22, all of 23, and all of 24. So much so that it ends up that Paul has to be taken out of Jerusalem and by the Romans imprisoned in Caesarea, and he's escorted up there by 200 infantrymen 70 cavalrymen and 200 men with spears. Almost 500 Rome, almost the whole garrison out of Antonia has to escort Paul up because he is about to be killed and things are so very bad. So you have a pivotal event intended to appease. Coming out of that is the rumor that we have right here. This again brings about the riot, chapter 21, verse 31. It says they were seeking to kill him. A report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. And at once he took some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So that the crowd then riots. Pivotal event, rumor, and the crowd riots. Paul is about to be killed at this point. And the next thing, and I'm just showing these boxes to show that one thing happens after another. They cascade through these particular chapters. He has to have a Roman rescue. So the Romans rescue Paul, who is about to be killed by the crowds. Now, when the riot occurred, something else branches off from that, and that is this, and we'll draw a box down here to the side, coming off of the riot, and that is this. The man responsible, the Roman commander responsible for peace in Jerusalem, has to find out, because he has to answer, why did this riot happen? So coming off the crowd riot, is, we'll put, the Roman responsibility. He's got to find out what has happened. And in order to do so, he's going to make attempt after attempt. The first attempt that is made is found in chapter 21 and verse 21:34. The commander and his troops come up, they rescue Paul, and they attempt to find out, verse 33, the last clause, he began asking who he was and what he had done. He had to have his answer because of his relationship to the Roman government. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing, some another, and when he could not find out the facts on account of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And he takes him upstairs. Paul says, "Can I address the crowd?" So after the Roman rescue, then you have the address to the crowd. And that is in chapter 23, beginning at verse 1. The thing I want you to see is notice how one event can be so critical. The event of agreeing to appease the Jews in this Jewish ceremony ends up in a rumor, and it simply cascades one thing after. It's a whole domino effect that occurs, and it shows the importance of one decision. Everything that's going to happen to this man in the following area is going to be due to this decision to try to appease the Jews. Well, the crowd listens, and we've been through it. The crowd listens as Paul preaches. Chapter 22, brethren, fathers, hear my defense. And things go fairly well until verse 21. And in verse 21, Paul testifies that God said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." And when he said that sentence, we move down another block, and it triggers another riot. And they listen to him, verse 22, up to this statement. And then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were crying out, throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust in the air. So our next block down is simply another riot comes out of the speech. And the riot is triggered when Paul says words about the Gentile commission. And all of the Jewish nationalism, all of the Jewish patriotism, comes to the fore, and again they literally go crazy. And so verse 24 says, another Roman rescue. The second one. And the Roman rescue occurs coming down into chapter 22 and verse 24. The commander ordered him to be brought to the barracks, stating that he could be examined by scourging. So the Roman rescue now assumes that this is a Jewish matter, and that is going to be an inquisition to get the truth out of. Remember, the Roman authority has to find out what caused this. So he suggests inquisition by scourging. And as you recall, as Paul is being prepared for scourging, he says those magic words, I am a Roman. And when he says those, the centurion goes to the commander and says, this man claims to be a Roman. And he says, untie him, let him loose. He has Roman rights. And so the Roman rescue occurs. And yet, the fact that the Roman responsibility is still there to find out the truth, we still have to do that. And therefore, you move down to the next block. And the next block is going to be an attempt again to find out after that rescue what the situation was. And thus, in chapter 22, since the Roman cannot find out, you have the call of the Sanhedrin. See if they can find out what is happening. And that is in chapter 23, verse 30, of chapter 21. Brought to the commander, given permission to speak, and again Paul has an address of the crowd. And as is the case, as Paul defends himself, chapter 23, 1 through 9, before the Sanhedrin, notice coming down to verse 10, there was great dissension developing. The commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him to the barracks. The Lord reinforces his support of Paul, and you have in verse 12 and following another Roman rescue. And so, and the chain doesn't end. And where does it go? Powerful lesson. Look at all of this riot, all of this tumult that came from one single decision. We're going to do a Jewish act in order to appease the Jewish people. And it's not a matter of a mistake that has consequences. It's doing something that has consequences, and from the consequences flow more and more and more and more. So you can see why I could say that this decision, when he arrived at Jerusalem on the day after he arrived, whether you believe it was a right decision or a wrong decision, did it ever have impact? And we're still not through with the impact as we come down to chapter 24, and it's going to go on and on and on and on. And if you believe that it was a mistake to try to appease, one thing for sure, it didn't work. It backfired over and over again, and if there's a lesson that comes out of that, there is nothing ever to be gained from appeasement. Paul was reasonable. Paul was willing to adapt. But here, the elders laid on him the idea that you've got to appease these Jews. And I doubt that Paul would have ever agreed to it had he known what was going to happen in all this sequence of events. The rumor that comes out of it, the riot, the rescue, address the crowd, another riot, a Roman rescue, the call of the Sanhedrin. He dresses the crowd, and there's going to be another rescue as he is brought before the Sanhedrin. This event coming down to chapter 23, when it says he looked at the council, this is the fifth time in the New Testament that the council has ruled on Christianity. Let's list them coming up to this. And we're looking at rulings of the High Court of Israel. How has that court ruled toward Israel? And let's go to the first one. And each one, there was a focus on a person. The first ruling was concerning Jesus. And this will demonstrate how officially the nation, through her Supreme Court, ruled against Christianity and for the death of Christians over and over and over again. We're looking at Matthew 26, 63 through 66. Matthew 26, 63 through 66. And that will bring us up to where we are, which is the fifth ruling of the High Court on Christianity. Matthew 26. Verse 63. The high priest asked Jesus, "What is it that these men are testifying against you?" In verse 63. And this is the first official appearance before the Sanhedrin, the high court. Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Messiah, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robe, saying, "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you now have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And the answer, "He is deserving of death." So, first appearance before the high court is Jesus must die. And we're going to arrive down in the instance with Paul in Acts where they're going to say the same thing. He must die. The violent reaction to Christianity. This is the first appearance. The second one focuses on Peter and John in Acts 4. Concerning Peter and John in Acts 4. This will show the complete and the total intolerance of the nation officially for Jesus. Acts 4. Second ruling of the High Court with respect to Christianity and the person of Christ. Chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Peter and John have been put in jail for the preaching of Christ. And in verse 5, it came about on the next day that the rulers and elders and scribes were gathered together in Jerusalem. That would comprise, again, the high court, the Sanhedrin. And Annas, the high priest, was there, and Caiaphas and John and Alexander, all who were high priestly descent. And then you follow down to verse 18. And when they, the high court, had summoned them, the apostles, they commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. And the response is direct defiance. We cannot help but speak in his name. So Jesus must die. Second ruling of the high court. And that had, by this time, Jesus had died. But now it goes further. Jesus must not be preached. Jesus must not be spoken of. And if the first ruling says we've got to wipe out his person, the second ruling says we've got to wipe out his memory. You can't even talk about him, and that's the violent reaction to Christ. Number three, appearance before the Sanhedrin was concerning all 12. Of the apostles. Concerning all 12 apostles. Acts 5, verse 27. 5:27. And when they had brought them, that's all of the apostles, they stood them before the Sanhedrin, the council. And the high priest questioned them, saying, "We gave you strict orders not to continue teaching in this name, and behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and tend to bring this man's blood upon us. Peter responds by his sermon and the refusal to be quiet in the name of Christ. Fortunately, this time things come out a little bit better, but notice what they were intending to do at verse 33. When they, the Sanhedrin, heard this, they were cut to the quick, and they were intending to slay them. So, intention to slay his followers. We have nothing but the most intense opposition. First appearance, we must kill him. Second appearance, we must not even hear the name. We must wipe out his memory. Third, if you're his follower, we're going to kill you. Fortunately, at this point, Gamaliel comes in, mediates, and his advice is respected. Next is the council rules concerning Stephen. Acts chapter 7, 12. 7, 12. Or 7, 1 and 2. 7, 1 and 2. Notice he's 6:15, I guess, is it? Last part of the chapter. Fixing their gaze on him, all who were sitting in the council, the Sanhedrin, saw his face like the face of an angel. And the high priest said, "Are these things so?" And you have that long sermon that is preached by Stephen to the Sanhedrin. And you come down to verse 58. When they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him. And the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul. So concerning Stephen, he is killed for preaching Jesus. And I hope this is adequate to show the vehement official hatred of the nation for the person of Christ. And now we go to fifth appearance before the Sanhedrin. And that fifth appearance is going to be concerning Paul this time. And that is Acts 23. And verse 1, Paul, looking intently at the council, said, and he begins to speak, the violent reaction is there, and finally, you have a requirement down at verse 12 that a conspiracy. Paul is rescued by the Romans, and now we move to continued plots, and that's where we really want to begin right now. The plot of the radical Jews. So, plot to kill Paul. This is one of the most violent encounters in the book of Acts, and we begin with its design, its discovery, and its defeat. Its design. 23, 12 through 15. And in that design to kill Paul, we'll break it down into the two elements that were there. Element one, element two. Element one focuses around the vows that 40 radical Jews are going to take. So the vows, chapter 23, verse 12. And when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under oath, saying they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. So we focus on the vows. And when it says in verse 12 that they bound themselves, the Greek word is the word in the verb form anathema. So, the first thing they do is they anathematized themselves. They anathematized themselves. And our version says bound, and anathema is the word translated bound. They anathematized themselves. Now, what does that mean? First of all, the word anathema means to be cursed by God. And it was used by the Jews in their vows. And what it simply meant was this. If I do not do and accomplish what I vow to do, may God Himself curse me. I am willing to be under the... I am so determined that I am going to carry out this vow that if I don't, I am perfectly willing for God to anathematize me, for God to judge me, for God literally to damn me. Now, notice they vow that they will not eat or drink until they kill Paul. Now, if that is the case, and if they did not eat or drink until they had killed Paul, and this was carried out, what happened to all of them? They were all starved, because they do not succeed. And the Jews and rabbis recognize that people do vows for different reasons. And therefore, let me give you the four ways, or four kinds of vows recognized by the rabbis. Four kinds of vows. And when we finish the four kinds of vows, you will find out this. You can get out of any vow. Number one, they said there are certain vows that we call vows of incitement. And that simply recognizes the fact that sometimes all of us at one point in life perhaps have been incited to do something by someone else, and we wouldn't have done it had they not, what do we say, lit our fire. And the Jews and the rabbis recognize that you may have made a vow because someone lit your fire. Well, if someone lit your fire and you can call that a vow of incitement, then you can get out of it. The second was vows of... What other way can we make a vow that, in an emotional context, you can swear to God, I will never sin again in my life? They had vows of exaggeration. I mean, that's enough loopholes right there for all of us, isn't it? The first one, the devil made me do it. The second one, I was in an emotional state and I said... That's even a figure of speech. What parent has not said it? I'm going to kill that kid. That's an exaggeration. And the Jews recognize sometimes you can do that in a vow, and therefore if you felt you exaggerated, you were out of your vow. So you can see by now, vows were easy to get out of. Another one was a vow in error. That would mean you made a vow, and you understood that the enemy had burned your house down. And you said on the way home, I vow to God I will neither eat nor drink until I find and kill the people that burned down my house. And you get home, and what do you find out? It was a rumor. The house isn't burnt. And so they said you ought to be able to get out of that one because it was a vow made in error. And, of course, when you want to get out of something... You need a catch-all, and this is a vow one cannot fulfill. Maybe a vow to avenge such and such vengeance on your enemy, and when it comes time to fulfill that vow, your enemy has moved from the country, or your enemy's dead, or you can't find your enemy, and therefore you would be excused from that vow. So notice, I'm sure, I don't know what these men might have pled, but they certainly ate again, and they certainly drank again, and Paul was certainly alive, but probably they used one of these four typical rabbinic methods whereby you could get out of a vow. And that is the first element that's in the design to kill Paul. The second element is the Sanhedrin. Element two. Let's get the Sanhedrin to help us. That's verses 14 and 15 of chapter 24. Or chapter 23, right?
23, notice verse 13 notes that there were 40 who formed this plot. And we'll find out that these 40 were willing to die in order to kill Paul. They knowingly decide that when the Romans bring him out, we're going to ambush him somewhere in the streets of Jerusalem, and we're going to kill him. And of course, that would be at peril of their own life. This means there's going to be bloodshed because Paul would be accompanied by Roman guards, and therefore there's going to be death. So these men are really determined. There was more than 40 who formed this plot. And they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." And being the mature court of Israel, standing for righteousness and justice, the court says, "You must not do that. We stand for justice." Well, hardly. "Now therefore," verse 15, "you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. For we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near this place." And if we want to put the physical surroundings that are involved in it, brought down means brought down from the fortress of Antonia, which was just north of the temple area, through the temple area and down to the southwest corner. At the southwest corner would be the Sanhedrin and where they would meet. And that's not a long distance. But they simply said, you say to the Roman cohort or Roman commander, "We're not through investigating Paul. We have more questions to ask him. Would you please send him down?" And so responding to that, they say, "Between the fort of Antonia and the Sanhedrin building where you guys are meeting, we'll see. He doesn't set foot in here. He'll be dead along the way." Where does this all start? If you will appease, you will please. And it all starts with that thing, and this is a continuous string of event that comes off of that one particular area. Now, we ought to, when it says that these men took a vow, that means a religious vow. And the vow meant, "I'm doing this before God," which would mean that their desire to kill Paul is considered a religious duty in the name of God. Had the disciples been warned of that, go to John 16. And they had been well informed earlier that this kind of persecution, being put to death by people who believe they're acting in the name of God, was going to truly happen to them. Chapter 16 of John. "These things I have spoken to you, that you may be kept from stumbling. They will make you outcasts from the synagogue. But an hour is coming for everyone who kills you to think that he is offering service to God." And therefore, these 40 Jews take a vow, and they say, "Before God, we are going to do our duty. We are going to kill Paul." And so the Sanhedrin is brought into it, and that's where we are in chapter 23, verses 14 and 15. And so if you think of the sin that's involved, hypocrisy for the high court. They're going to pretend that he's going for questioning when he is not. Deceit. Complicity of the court with those who want to violate law. Murder. And all of that in the name of God. I suppose you know, then, coming off of this mentality, you can understand the contemporary scene where Muslims act in the name of Allah to honor him by killing, by deceit, by any other means if possible. And that's the same mentality that you have here on the part of the Jews, is the mentality that we're seeing in the Middle East today. So really, whether the ambush was successful or not, they knew there's going to be loss of life. No question about that. You can't take 40 Jews, and as we'll see, Paul was, when he is taken out of the city, 470, the infantry, 200 of them, the spearmen, 200 of them, 70 cavalry are taken to spirit Paul out of Jerusalem. You can imagine what had happened if the plot had gone on. There would probably have been a few Roman soldiers to escort him down. And, of course, the Roman soldiers were armed. He would certainly have gone with an escort. And as someone comes out to ambush Paul, there would have been bloodshed, probably on the part of the Romans. Perhaps Paul would have been killed, and there would have certainly been loss of life on the part of the 40. So they are viciously willing. They're fanatical. And if we get killed, trying to kill, and we succeed killing Paul, then it is well worth it. And that's the spirit and the attitude that we have in this context. That is then, number one, the design. That's the plan. Two. Where did all of this come from? The elders said, you've got to appease the Jews. And Paul does. And literally, one of the most vivid examples I know anywhere in the Bible of the utter futility of appeasement is in these chapters we're going through right now. Well, it's design, now it's discovery. 16 through 22. And the event that we're going to look at in 16 through 22 is going to display two things. Number one, it displays the providential care of God. And two, it's going to show the value of Roman citizenship. And that carries a lesson with it. Paul certainly trusted in the care of God, but he also used all the cards in his deck. What this says is simply this, by way of principle. God will take care of you. Keep your insurance payments up. And that's exactly what you've got here. God will take care of you is His providence and His sovereignty. And the fact that Paul pled and successfully did so with his Roman citizenship means be sure that your insurance is paid up also. So, verse 16. This is a rare verse. It's one of the few places we get a little look into Paul's family. Typically, with Paul coming to Christianity, he would be excommunicated from his family, his Jewish family. But apparently his sister has some affection for Paul and has passed that on to Paul's nephew, who I take was probably a little boy when he came in to plead and inform of the plot, the Roman soldier takes him by the hand. I wouldn't want to be escorted by a Roman soldier by the hand. So I think probably the explanation, this must have been a very young boy that was being led by the soldier. At least I hope so. Verse 16. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. Perhaps because he was a little boy and they figured those ears maybe didn't even know the relationship. He heard of the ambush and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, by the way, you know why the little boy got in? And do you know why the Roman centurion is going to tell his commander? He was a Roman citizen. And that's going to be the value of using the proper means. Paul called one of his centurions to him and said, lead this man to the... And I know it seems strange that a prisoner would be asking and almost commanding is the centurion or his guard to do something. But the Romans, if you're a Roman citizen, you had the right to visitors, to receive visitors whenever you wished, and you also had the right to ask the centurion to do certain tasks that you could not do for himself. So he's really obligated. Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. So he took him, led him to the commander, and said, Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you. The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it you have to report to me? He said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him who have bound themselves under a curse or a vow not to eat or drink until they slay him. Now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. Therefore the commander let the young man go, instructing him to tell no one that you notified me of these things. And that moves on to, then, how we have the plot, its defeat. Its design, its discovery, 16 through 22, and now its defeat. It's a mix of the sovereignty of God using necessary means to bring about a delivery. The thought of the commander is, we've got to get Paul out of here and up to Caesarea. So now the time in Jerusalem is over. And if you stop back and look at it, how fruitful has it been? Really, I know of no fruit that was born in this particular period. Only trouble and problems and so forth as Paul returns to that city. So, verse 23, he called to him two centurions and said, get 200 soldiers. A centurion obviously was over 100 soldiers, so two officers with his 100 men, get them ready by 9 o'clock tonight to proceed to Caesarea, Roman headquarters. We want 70 horsemen or cavalrymen and 200 spearmen. That's quite a force. 470 military. The object was twofold. The object of delivering in this way was, one, speed, two, security. The infantrymen would provide, the way it would work would be the cavalrymen with Paul. Notice they got a mount for Paul also. Verse 24, they were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So the method in the Roman strategy of warfare would be, you get your cavalry out first, because that's speed. But what are you going to do if the enemy attacks from the rear? Well, that would be the infantrymen. So you got the 70 cavalrymen going on. You've got the infantrymen, and then they are kept by the spearmen, which are ready to go into battle. And if you can picture all of this at 9 o'clock at night, Paul being placed on a fast horse, and off they speed from the fort of Antonia with 70 cavalrymen with him. 200 soldiers follow. 200 soldiers follow them. With them they have a letter, and the letter to the governor, Felix, is in 26 through 30. There's nothing in it that we've not seen so far. It's a summary type thing that is sent to them, coming down through verse 30, and again you can read it, it's self-explanatory. So verse 31, the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul, brought him by night to Antipatris, and the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks, and when these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him, and when he had read it, he asked from what province he was. When he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. So Paul is out of Jerusalem. He is now safe in the Roman fortress, and he is kept at that particular point. And he is going to wait in order for the rest to arrive. And we have just enough time then to introduce Paul's third defense. Paul's defense before Felix. And that begins with chapter 24, 1 through 27, at the end of the chapter. Don't let the name Felix mislead you. If Felix were a real Felix, I really wouldn't worry about standing before Felix. But this Felix is a vicious, vicious man. And notice in chapter 24 what the way Luke sets forth and a few things just introductory coming in this defense. In his account, Luke gives almost equal space to three things in his account. Number one, the Jewish charges. And there will be, of those Jewish charges, three. And they are in 24, 1 through 9. Second, he gives Paul's reply. 24, 10 through 21. The charges will be emotional. Paul will answer the three charges in a row. They were tainted. They say Paul is a diseased bird. It was a word for a diseased, predatory bird. It's translated in our version in what, verse 20, verse 5 of chapter 24, where they say, "We have found this man a real test." And the word "test" is the Greek word for diseased, predatory bird. So if you can manage a mangy hawk with disease and filth and lice, that's the way they look at Paul. That's not a very dignified way to present a courtroom case, no matter what may be, because it prejudices the thing, but nonetheless, that was what Tertullus does, and Tertullus, the high priest, really wants to get this job done, so he hires an attorney. And the attorney is named Tertullus, and he speaks for the high priest. And really makes a masterful charge. But Tertullus makes a charge where if Paul had been before the Sanhedrin, they would have put him to death. And he also makes a charge that was a capital offense under Roman law. So Paul replies to that in 10 through 31, 21. And then you have Felix getting almost equal time. Felix's response, 24, 22, through the end of the chapter. Now, one other point of introduction. The Sanhedrin, and I hope I use the right words that will get across the point. The charges of the Sanhedrin are very skillfully devious. I think that's the best way to do it. They're skillfully devious. The judge, Felix, was notoriously corrupt and violent. There will be three charges made. And the first one, all by itself, should light Felix's fire. Felix had a means of handling people that revolted and caused riot. Josephus gives a record of them. Maybe next time I'll read some to you. Josephus has a record of how at the time in Judea, describing how many people Felix had crucified because of sedition. So if Felix, as corrupt as he is impressed by this charge, then Paul would have faced the same fate that Christ did, namely crucifixion. Well, we will learn one other thing, and we close with this. In Paul's appearance, two conclusions can be very clearly made. Number one, and Felix sees this, he sees it. Number one, that Christianity has nothing to do with political sedition. That will be made abundantly clear. And number two, the reason that the Jews hated Christianity so much is because Christianity claimed to be fulfillment of the Old Testament messianic prophecy. And that will become abundantly clear. We'll pick up at this point as Paul begins to address Felix, and really a fairly favorable, he gets much fairer treatment before Felix and Festus than he does before the Jews because of the demonstrated hatred that started with the Sanhedrin condemning Christ to death. Father, we're thankful tonight for the book of Acts. We're thankful for the enormous courage of Paul. We tend to think of him as a preacher in a shirt and tie, neatly dressed, and yet that wasn't Paul. He was scarred, he was battered, he was hated, he was in daily peril for his life, and all he did was proclaim Christ as Savior. And therefore, may we learn the many lessons involved in here, one of them being the enormous hostility of the human heart toward the Savior of man. And thus, we pray that as we continue, we will grow in grace and in knowledge of Him in Christ's name.